是中国。
That's why China, the China podcast from Thuringia in Germany.
Welcome. I'm Benjamin Creutzfeldt, and I'm very happy to have two wonderful guests for today's session, Cynthia Sanborn and Francisco Ordinez. Let me introduce them both briefly. Cynthia is the director of the Center for China and Asia Pacific and full professor in the Academic Department of Social and Political Sciences at Universidad del Pacifico in Lima, Peru. She holds a PhD and MA in government from Harvard University. And she has published widely and has done a lot of research. I've been privileged in the past to work with her in Peru and works especially on Chinese presence in Peru and Latin America. Hi, Cynthia.
Thank you very much.
Francisco Ordinez is an associate professor at the Political Science Institute at the Pontifical Catholic University of Chile and the director of Millennium Nucleus of China's Impacts in Latin America and the Caribbean. He has also published widely many papers on issues relating to China and Chile, China and Latin America. And I might say both of them have been Wilson Fellows in Washington, D.C. at different points, as have I. So we have sort of a brotherhood going on here, or sisterhood. Hello, Francisco.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
So let's just kick off, bearing in mind that this relationship between the growing presence of China and Latin America is something that we have been dealing with for many years, but to many of the listeners, it is less familiar. I'm just going to throw this question out at you. How would you describe, in a few words, how has China's economic engagement with countries on the Pacific Coast of Latin America evolved over the past decade, particularly in light of projects like the Chancay Megaport in Peru? And concurrently, you may want to talk to how the dynamic in these countries has evolved as they deal with China. Cynthia, why don't you start off?
Okay, thank you. Well, it's a good question. I think it's pretty clear that the economic engagement from our countries on the Pacific coast with China has deepened considerably in the last decade. In fact, although I think Brazil remains the sort of number one recipient of Chinese investment, the countries up and down the coast are almost half of what China's doing in the last decade, particularly in new sectors for us like energy and infrastructure. And I think as the economic relationship with China deepens, the political relationship as well. I think that it's clear that most of the countries on the Pacific coast of South America are trying very hard to maintain on good terms with China, as well as with the United States and the European Union.
Francisco, you have a view from slightly further south, from Chile.
I think engagement with China has been exponential. There's a free trade agreement, and Chile has one of the largest shares of exports towards China in the world. 40% of exports go to China. Peru's exports are also almost there. Both countries have similarities. They both export minerals and are extremely engaged with the Chinese market. They both have also received major sums of Chinese investment. So in less than 15 years, China became a major economic superpower, and that also translated into political influence and China becoming a day-to-day issue that people speak of. But there's interest in China now, in newspapers and in public opinion.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, we've had, I think, in the last decade, maybe 17 presidential visits from countries on the Pacific coast of South America to China. There's obviously a back and forth. We had Xi Jinping here in a little over 10 years ago, and we had him again here last year for the APEC meetings in Peru and the G20 meetings in Brazil as well. The presence is felt, as Francisco said, and it's in trade as well as investment, and it's in new sectors as well as traditional sectors of minerals, and also in large infrastructure. You alluded to the Chancay Port, which is a Peruvian-Chinese collaborative initiative. It's a private initiative from the perspective of Peru, but obviously of great interest to China, witnessing the president of China participating in the inauguration of the port. And it's a port that promises to be a hub for all of South America with Asia. You know, I just reiterate, the engagement has intensified for most of the countries on the Pacific coast, and I would say Peru and Chile in particular. It's been asymmetric but beneficial. And you can't say the same for all of our relations with other countries in the world.
Right. We can go into some details maybe later and also look at other countries. Panama springs to mind since it has been in the press just recently, mainly from the US side. But I'll stick with my initial questions that I sent you, and also the topic, the sort of framing of this podcast is economic statecraft. And so My second question really is, in the media, I can say especially in the US, there is often talk of Chinese control and coercion. You just mentioned the word influence, but there's often this notion that they're somehow, that China can somehow, beyond influence, maybe control or coerce smaller countries, such as those in Latin America. Are there examples of China or other major powers using economic leverage to influence political decision-making in Peru or Chile? Do you want to go first, Francisco?
Yes. So there's something interesting about economic statecraft. You could use positive incentives or negative ones. I think China has chose positive incentives, which means using economic means, investment, trade, to shape the agency on its favor. I haven't seen much of coercive side, but when it comes to the large asymmetries that Cynthia was mentioning, sometimes you could see instances in which there's threats to stop buying certain materials, and that brings, you know, that creates a lot of leverage to Chinese negotiators. There's a few instances of that in Chile with the cherry market. In Argentina, we have seen that with the soy market. But I would say that China has used mostly the carrots rather than the sticks. Another interesting issue about economic statecraft is that one expects to see intentionality. And sometimes I'm not that sure that China, as a big actor, as a unitarian actor, has a broad and clear strategy, and every single thing that we observe in this part of the world is a result of a concrete strategy. I tend to think that there's some of that, but there's also externalities. There's hundreds of economic actors from China, and they do create effects. So as Chiang Kai, that Cynthia was mentioning, that was Costco in a private initiative with Peruvian mining company. And only when that started to create some sort of political leverage, I think the Chinese government paid attention to it. So sometimes projects become mainstream later in time for the Chinese government. There's a huge array of actors from China uncoordinately working in this part of the world. And I think that embassies and the government doesn't have a very clear view of how each of these actors are acting in terrain. I think no one knows. With Cynthia and other projects, we're trying to map them because it's so complex that it's very hard to keep track of all of them.
Well, briefly on the mapping, you've done some work on that. There was a lot going on in terms of building goodwill from the Chinese side. Maybe you just want to throw some of that in from your research.
We have tried in these countries, in Chile, Peru, Argentina as well, to, again, map, use official data, but also news and governmental communiques from local governments in South America to kind of map the footprint of Chinese actors, the sums of investments, which actors are engaging with local players in South America. We have mapped COVID aid during the pandemic, which came through very different types of actors in China, provincial actors, municipalities, foundations, universities, state-owned enterprises, and of course, the formal governmental channel through the embassies. But it's much more complex than what you would expect, in the sense that all these Chinese actors, when you sum all this aid, looks like a very large sum of help, but it was not always part of the same strategy or same campaign. There were various different campaigns taking place, and some of them were at the initiative of local players here in South America. So there's a demand side that sometimes we forget. We choose to engage with the Chinese at times because they provide certain goods that we cannot get anywhere else. And then the Chinese respond to that demand. And same with investment, because we have greenfield investments, acquisitions, and all sorts of complexities that it's very hard to keep track. And what we find is that the footprint of Chinese actors is very large, sometimes larger than what we would expect. So coming back to the statecraft question, I think they have lots of tools, lots of actors that can exert power here for the good or the bad. But again, to refer to the concept, they have become very influential. They have a lot of leverage on what's going on in this part of the world.
as hard as it is for researchers to keep tabs, you also saying it seems to be difficult for Beijing itself to keep tabs and to have a full overview of what's going on. There is a lot of individual actors. Maybe Cynthia, you want to speak to that?
Yeah, I want to speak to that as well. I mean, you didn't get much diversity. I think we're very much aligned, and that's because we work together and we have similar outlook on the relations with China, which is about statecraft, as you said. I agree with Francisco that we don't think the central powers in Beijing necessarily are in control of everything that's happening on the ground. And our efforts to map have gone beyond the traditional kind of economist's obsession with FDI numbers and how much money is coming from China, which is very difficult always to map. And we've mapped how many companies, what kind of companies, what parts of each country they're in, what kind of labor force they have, if their property is public or private in China, if they belong to the central government in China or subnational governments, because we really want to understand this actor that is not unitary, as Francisco said. And we've really advanced in Argentina, Chile, Peru and Colombia in this mapping effort, as well as with kind of empirical and ethnographic work on the ground to see how those relations are playing out. But I think that going back to the issue of statecraft or coercion, I would just say I don't see strong evidence, perhaps the very exceptions, like Francisco said, with the cherries for a moment in Chile. But for the most part, the kind of overt coercion or use of economic leverage with our countries, we must say it comes from the United States, and it has come before the Trump administration. But in the last couple of days, Chile and Peru have been threatened rhetorically directly. I mean, the Trump administration has threatened to put tariffs on Chilean copper. They've threatened to punish anyone who uses the Chancay port. And it may be all hot air right now, but that's certainly where the coercion discourse is coming from, as opposed to, as Francisco said, the engagement and the asymmetrical but mutually beneficial types of interaction. I would just add to, in addition to direct investment from China, we're seeing an expansion of Chinese involvement in public works and services. And in countries like Peru, Chile, and Colombia, most big public works are through open competitive bidding. So they're not government to government. They're not giving the Chinese some kind of unusual political advantage, but they're winning contracts. They're winning bids to do highways and bridges and other ports and things. And that's in part because our own domestic construction firms aren't able to do all that. And the Brazilians pulled out a while ago for reasons that we know. So that's another phenomenon that's recent and important. And there are European firms bidding as well, of course, and getting contracts as well.
Actually, you might just make a little asterisk to what you said. I don't know how widely known the Odebrecht scandal is.
In South America, there was something called the car wash scandal with large companies from Brazil, particularly Odebrecht and a few others, involved in building major public infrastructure in a number of our countries. And it's been documented through investigation from the U.S. and from each of our countries, the amount of money that went under the table through bribes to politicians in order to bypass various filters that you should go through to do public works. And we have works like the Interoceanic Highway that connects us to Brazil, which we now have, you know, more than one president who's been charged and one in jail for taking bribes in order to allow the Brazilians to go through. So the Brazilian companies ultimately have pulled out, as well as a number of our construction firms that have gotten burnt. And now the question is, are we capable of regulating big infrastructure investment that comes from Spain, Germany, France, China, Canada, or elsewhere, right? Because we want to avoid that happening again.
That is a fascinating sort of footnote in history, and see how it further develops. You mentioned politicians without naming names specifically, but this is something I'd like to look at in a moment. First, I have one more question to both of you about this coercion issue. So one would think that the pressure that a country like China can apply depends on how great the dependency is of the country. So we see in Germany that the car industry is terribly concerned. Their biggest market is China. They produce a lot there. They're even upset about higher tariffs on imports from China because they themselves build vehicles there. The same go. Many countries have grown huge dependencies in various sectors, including the United States. So would you say, I've always looked to Chile and Peru as countries that have wide customer base, we could call it, if you were a shop. In other words, you have greater dependency. You export as much to the US as you do to China and in the region and even Europe, and broadly speaking. Would you say that, you know, comparing maybe your countries or others, Colombia, also smaller Central American states, is something you could observe? Is this a conscious effort? Is this something that really saves you from too much coercion from anyone?
In the case of Chile, there's a huge concern now on diversifying more the export market. There's been talks in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in reaching India, Vietnam, and Indonesia as a means to try not to expose Chile so much to the current trade war. It's expected that this new Trump administration will affect how Chile engages with China. Again, Chile exports 40% of its goods to China. It used to be more diversified, its basket, than what it is nowadays, because also a huge chunk of that 40% is comprised of copper. So there's an agency in Chile called Pro Chile, which is an agency that it's particularly designed to open new markets. It's interesting because we say China, but Chile has diversified its trade with China within China. There's more trade with provinces like Sichuan, where Chile opened a new consulate. So Chile put effort in exporting to poorer provinces in China rather than the typical markets. And that was made through an explicit strategy of Pro Chile. Now there's concerns, and now they want to diversify the Asian market going to these new countries. Chile has a broad array of free trade agreements. It exports mostly commodities. So the intention is there. I think the government can do it, but it takes time. Sometimes these shifts take 2-3 years. And I am personally very, very curious to see how easy that is to be done. I want to see what role plays Chiangkai that Cynthia was mentioning in as the path dependence tool that will deepen these dependencies in terms of trade, because it's been very beneficial for us to export to China. They are very eager to buy our commodities, and it's a market that have worked very well for us. It's a very challenging thing, I think, that we are facing for the next few years, which is try to lower our exposure to China and try to engage more with Southeast Asian countries and also with Europe. The problem of the European market, and most of your audience is in Europe, I guess, is that sometimes the standards are much higher. For example, for cherry salmon, the standards are way higher than what the Chinese market requires. But that takes longer, even longer, to readapt. And here we are. It's probably one of the top priorities of the foreign policy at this moment.
I would add to that by saying that we have two kinds of export agreements. We have fixed longer or medium-term agreements. I mean, the minerals that we ship, and Chile and Peru both have copper. Peru also has gold and silver and iron and other things. But most of the copper and most of the iron we export to the Chinese market, and we have fixed agreements with the different producers. We only have four Chinese companies producing copper. We have a number of European and American companies producing it. But it's really hard to diversify what you have long-term agreements for, right? In new investments, and I think Chile or Argentina are interesting because they have lithium, which has kind of boomed in recent years, and they have the opportunity to rethink the diversification of markets and encourage others to invest in their lithium with different kinds of agreements with added value, et cetera. And that's a kind of new opportunity, as Francisco said, to diversify, because clearly the Chinese are very interested in the lithium as well and would be happy to purchase it. With produce as well, I mean, I think Chile has really boomed and really depended on the Chinese market for many of its fruits. But the U.S. market is also very important. It's more important for us. But if the U.S. starts to shut down its markets, which some of the noise is coming from, the Chiangkai port is perfectly positioned for us to export more to Asia. So if the U.S. starts complaining about the Chiangkai port, they should think twice about that's kind of driving us and neighboring countries into exporting more. We can export faster in larger amounts through that port now to Asia. But as a last comment, I would say I agree again with Francisco. Our governments are concerned about diversifying. Indonesia has signed free trade agreements with both of our countries recently, and we're looking to see what the Indonesian market wants and what they bring, Vietnam in our case, India and others. But we are looking to Asia, and we are looking to Asia for the reasons that were mentioned, and particularly because the U.S. is becoming more protectionist about what it receives.
Yes, certainly. We can observe that. And both of you have sort of alluded to recent threats from the United States that they might drive decision makers and companies to lean more on East Asia and China in particular. So recently there was a lot of bluster the last few days. Maybe you saw it in the press from Colombian President Gustavo Petro, and he obliquely but also quite clearly indicated that, you know, if the tariffs are raised from the United States for goods from Colombia, then they will look to others, others always being primarily China. Has this entered the political debate much? We know that in Brazil and in Argentina, it was in the campaign mode especially, you know, China is front and center. And in the US, it has also been very, very prominent. But is this so in Peru, Chile, or neighboring countries?
You know, in our case, yes, we've had a lot of presidents. They come and go much, much more frequently than we'd like. But we have had only one central bank president for the last 25 years. And the professional staff at the Ministry of Trade and the Ministry of Economy and Finance are more stable. And so it is one of these situations that political scientists, you know, freak out about, in which we have a tremendous stability in our foreign economic policy and trading policies and instability in other areas of politics. And favoring free trade agreements and favoring trade with both Asia and other parts of the world has been a constant for the last almost 25, 30 years, right? And that continues to be so. And I do think, I mean, it's not just the threat with Colombia, which had this interaction on Sunday that was kind of shocking a lot of us, but the threats to Chile, the threats to Peru, the threats to other countries in the region are real. And, you know, they may or may not happen. But for example, the cutoff of foreign aid that happened yesterday, you know, large numbers of organizations that are very friendly to the United States and have been doing a series of development activities with U.S. and USAID supporting suddenly got letters saying for 90 days they're getting no more support. So yes, of course, it feeds into the concern about establishing other partners, not only in trade, but in development assistance and other areas.
Yeah, and there are instances in which you see, to come back to economic statecraft, the U.S. using coercive measures to respond to China's influence. It's interesting because there seems to be no alternatives. There's no carrots most of the times to respond to China's influence in the region. There are a few examples, perhaps, but most of the times the State Department threatens South American countries that discuss some infrastructure projects with China, with Chinese investors. In Chile, there was an idea to deploy 5G cable that would go from Chile to China. That was utterly dismissed and blocked by the State Department. They, during Trump first, they were very, very much against it. The government in Chile decided not to push further. It wasn't clear also the economic returns, and they assumed it was too risky to go for it. Eventually, this is one of the few stories that ended happily. Google deployed a cable called Humboldt cable that plays more or less, or sort of fits more or less the needs that the Chinese cable would provide. However, most of the times, we miss a Chinese opportunity and nothing fills the gap. So we end up feeling that these carrots from the US only bring losses, in the sense that we brings losses because we cannot engage with the Chinese, but there are not American actors willing to play the role that Chinese will do. There's plenty of examples on that side. So we are playing a very tricky game here because, again, Chinese investors, Chinese buyers are key for us. We are developing countries. We depend on economic growth. We depend on selling and buying goods and receiving capital. The recent posture by Trump II, I would call him, which seems to be even more aggressive and approaching kind of a mercantilist posture, which is, we don't buy from you. We just want to sell to you. We don't care about raising tariffs. If we say no, it's no. That may end up making South American countries lean even more towards China, because very important to mention that we lean towards China because China is instrumental. It's not simply that we love the Chinese and we have cultural attachment, a value attachment, or wherever. China meets a need, meets a demand that South American actors have. And it's been quite pragmatic in that sense. So I think Colombia, for example, which is one of the most beloved countries for the U.S. in the region, is the jewel of the crown for many reasons, may end up signing the BRI memo and leaning towards China in the next months. There will be a CELAC China Forum in Bogota, And I wouldn't be surprised if these last few days will end provoking a leaning of Colombia towards China, sort of protect itself from American advancements. I see China being an alternative at times to the U.S. policy towards the region.
To look beyond your two countries, I mean, another important one is Ecuador, where it's not, I think, so clear-cut. There was, you know, also a mega project like Chancay, but the Coca-Cola Sinclair Dam has technical structural problems. And it seems that the great friendship that Correa established with China was somewhat short-lived. Can you speak to that?
Well, I don't know very well, but I think, yes, you have a case of in some large investments, in this case, in the big hydro plant or investments in minerals in Ecuador that have been very controversial. They are in part due to the structural difficulties of the project, in part due to the social and environmental impact on local communities. Those type of investments in those type of sectors tend to be controversial, whether it's China or Canada or the U.S. investing. But in this case, it's kind of a new phenomena from China, and it hasn't gone over very well in Ecuador. But again, whether Ecuador will continue to have a more diverse market for its goods, its shrimp, its bananas, its other goods, remains to be seen. No, Ecuador is going through a lot of internal turmoil right now, and I can't say any more about what's going to happen there. They're going through some changes in the government as well soon.
15 years ago, Chinese policy banks, the China Development Bank and the Exim Bank, had a lot of incentives to lend money for large infrastructure projects. This money was lended to governments in South America and other parts of the world. And the very large projects that involved credits and state-owned enterprises deploying these infrastructure projects, I can think of dams in southern Argentina as well, and there are a few other examples. Those very large, huge projects of several billion dollars usually had problems. The trend has evolved into smaller projects in which there are private actors, private local actors, I mean South American companies being partners of Chinese companies. Policy banks almost do not lend anymore, but commercial banks like the ICBC and other commercial banks in China lend, but they lend less and they are more eager to control the evolution of the process. And local governments are also involved in the processes. I think the Chinese and us have learned the hard way. I mean, there are a few projects that went bad. And again, it's been so exponential, a relationship, that through a few bad projects, both sides have learned the lessons. The lessons for South Americans is that you need to control and you need to make sure that regulation plays a role, environmental regulation, transparency. These Chinese companies had huge incentives to invest abroad 15 years ago. Sometimes they're dealing with tens of projects across the globe. And it's not rare to see a same company from China behaving very well in one country and very badly in other countries. So we learned on how to regulate these companies. And again, I think that the trend now is to have smaller projects on newer industries. There's a lot of interest in renewables, for example. And I think those investments are going pretty well. They are easier to handle. And most of the time, they involve private actors. And my sensation is that they are, again, easier to handle for both sides, the Chinese and the Latin Americans. And it's going pretty well in that sense.
Yeah, I would add to that that a number of those projects in Venezuela, you didn't ask about Venezuela, but that's sort of the Venezuela and then Ecuador are sort of the stereotypical kind of deep debt problematic cases. But I think, again, China has learned and we're seeing an evolution, a rapid evolution in China's regulatory norms and standards for overseas investments. And catching up in terms of implementing them has been hard. But for our countries, we're watching and paying a lot of attention to how China starts to control more, regulate, worry more about the impact of its overseas investments because of a lot of international pressure it's received as well. And the G2G, the government-to-government projects, aren't the norm in some of our countries. I think neither Chile nor Peru have any government-to-government projects with China. It's all kind of open bidding or acquisitions through local partners, but a bit more transparent in that sense recently.
And as Francisco said, the interesting thing is in renewable energy and alternative forms of more sustainable energy, it seems to be largely private Chinese companies. And we know the issue of private in China is different than it may be elsewhere, but nonetheless, they're kind of more modern, more agile, and perhaps less likely to create the kind of problems that we've seen. But again, our capacity to regulate them is very important. It's mixed. Some countries are doing it better than others. But I do think the game has changed.
You've spoken very well of how more attuned your governments have become to China and how China is also sort of catching up on adapting. But of course, there's ever since I lived in Panama 20 years ago when China was first, you could say, rearing its head, sort of becoming more involved and being more present. And then in Colombia, there's always been the talk in the background sort of, oh, if only we could all sort of come together as a region. There's been some integration of individual countries like the Pacific Alliance, but there's always this thought, you know, if we want to face up and make policy effective for our people and our economies, then we need to do it jointly, like the European Union sort of model. Is this something that is still touted?
I think the discussions on the need for regional integration have always been there. This is the old story. As an international relations student, I recall my classes when I was an undergrad. The so-called golden times of UNASUR and so on are gone. And I say golden times, they were not so golden, but you know, those were very ambitious projects. I think now we are leaning towards less ambitious, more multilateral rather than multilateral, and more sectoral and concrete discussions than broad integration projects. I think we are trying to sectoral talks on, for example, transoceanic channels, trade connectivity in terms of 5G, coordination in environmental fora, like the COP meetings, but it's very sectoral. I don't see any attempt, even from the leftist governments, to, you know, bring back the old discussions on one region and one policy. We would certainly benefit from coordination towards China. China benefits from our bilateral approach towards China because there's a lot of repetition, I think. But for them, it's not much different to approach Peru than Chile and then Argentina. Of course, the asymmetries are larger, but this is a regional trend. We have no coordination almost anywhere. And again, the infrastructural connectivity is very poor compared to what Europe has in terms of ports and roads and closeness among people. We are very disconnected physically among each other, and that doesn't help at all.
Even in the case of the European Union, which for us is kind of very distant and unlikely to repeat, dealing with China has not been a unifying factor. As far as I understand, the European countries, even though that you may have all denoted China as a rival or a hostile actor or something, each country is doing it a bit differently, and they haven't been able to agree on dealing with or not dealing with China. And in Latin America, if the question is about whether we can cooperate in terms of some kind of integrated engagement or more power to negotiate with China, that's not happening and not very likely. As Francisco said, that it's all been so far pretty bilateral. And we would benefit from it. And I think, you know, the Pacific Alliance worked great for a while because it was four countries that shared the same economic model and approach to free trade. But that's dead. I mean, Mexico and Colombia pulled out some time ago. Our relations with both of them are not so strong. We come together perhaps around Venezuela for some issues related to democracy and human rights. But even there, there's distinct positions today. You know, perhaps the most interesting area of potential cooperation, if not full integration, would be in energy and the infrastructure around energy, because we all are going to need our own energy transition. It's coming on us now. And there's been some talk and there's been some interesting discussion. And I think that could be an interesting area because it's very practical. It's not so politicized. But so far, it's mostly talk. Now, again, I don't want to keep beating a very live horse, but the threats being coming from the United States may end up unifying some countries. I mean, Petro and the president of Honduras have called for a meeting tomorrow to discuss the deportees and how to engage with them. I suspect that many of our presidents don't want to get involved right now because they don't want to have to take a side or raise their head against the U.S. in this first few weeks. But there may be, you know, outside factors that encourage us to unite on certain key issues in relations with the North. But economic integration and an integrated approach to China, I don't see it happening.
Mercosur is an interesting case in that regard, Benjamin, because, well, there's a free trade agreement waiting to be ratified between Mercosur and the EU. China has tried to push for a free trade agreement with Mercosur, but there's a problem. Paraguay is still the only South American country that has diplomatic relations with Taiwan. So that's a very interesting case because it's a case in which a regional bloc blocks a deeper relationship with China. And there's been discussions on either destroying Mercosur or, you know, trying to make that clause a little bit more flexible, or simply discussing Paraguay's allegiance with Taiwan. So it has become a key issue within Mercosur itself. And it's one of the few cases, probably the only case, in which, again, a regional bloc cannot go further with China due to that issue in particular.
I'd like to just ask you both to speak briefly on something quite different, really, which is how do your students deal with Chinese influence at the moment? Because I know that in some countries in Europe, there's been a slight drop in people willing to study Chinese. They feel sort of it's yellow peril. The way the press speaks about China is tends to be negative. So many people think, oh, we better be looking somewhere else. But then there's also this been a countercurrent recently, the Red Note, Xiaohongshu app that has been so popular in the US and also across Europe. Suddenly people are flooding Chinese apps who have never looked at Chinese apps before. I'd be interested how your students, respectively, sort of engage, what their enthusiasm is. Are they all looking to get those Chinese scholarships, or are they still tend to think it's way too far away physically, to culturally, to engage? What's the sort of feeling you get, or what do you observe?
Well, I would say for us, it's booming. We have a club called the Hanyu Club, which is students interested in learning China and learning about Chinese culture. And we've got like 65 students who've signed up to be members in a small university. And I think the number of young people studying Chinese, wanting to visit China, perhaps not do their full degree programs there, but certainly wanting to take advantage of the different kind of study trips there, is increasing. And then the interest in China, obviously, by graduate students doing theses on international relations, international politics or economics, the interest in China and Asia is great. And there's a curious phenomena, which Francisco has probably experienced quite a bit too, is in the US, there's a whole several generations of China scholars who feel they can no longer go to China or no longer can focus on China. So they're starting to do global China studies. So we're also getting folks from the US and to some extent from Europe who want to come study China here in our neighborhood because they can't or don't want to continue doing work in China. So we've got both coming. We've got our own people interested and we've got people from the North wanting to study China here in the South.
Same here. It's also true what you mentioned, Benjamin. Some students are not as eager to go to China to pursue postgraduate studies as 10 years ago. Korea, South Korea is becoming very trendy. I am biased because I bring all the guys who are very interested into China. So there's a lot of great undergraduate students that work with us that are fluent in Chinese or they are studying Chinese. We have a Confucius Institute at our university and they are very engaged in acquiring skills that this older generation that I am part of do not have. They are extremely sensitive in terms of cultural issues towards China, very curious. It's a mixed view. So there's a group of students which are very much engaged, and I think they will be the next generation of China scholars probably. But in general, in our university, interest towards China or to study in China, is a bit less than what it used to be 15 years ago. It's interesting. We are monitoring public opinion in Chile, of what people think of China, and younger generations are very much exposed to China through their companies. So Alibaba and Xiaomi and Huawei are very well known and they have a pretty positive opinion on technology. And that's the way, probably the most important soft power that China has nowadays. Besides, there's no real consumption of Chinese music or Chinese cinema as it is with Korean or Japanese among younger people in our university. But technology, the cars, there's lots of Chinese cars in Santiago. You would be impressed, Benjamin, have become the way through which China is becoming known by younger people.
Another phenomenon that I would mention that it may happen in Chile or other countries, but certainly strong in Peru, is there's a class and ethnic distinction. We have a lot more students, lower income students, first generation students in public universities who find the scholarships or the opportunities to study in China more attractive, It's very expensive to go to study in the U.S. It's also difficult to win those scholarships to Germany and France. And so the scholarships that China offer for some time now have been more attractive, where students perhaps at the more elite private universities like ours still want to do their master's in Europe or in the U.S. as long as they can. But we also have the demographic. We have, you know, a large Chinese descendant population in Peru, the Tusan population. And we've seen a phenomena of the children, grandchildren, or great-grandchildren of Chinese immigrants wanting to go back, whereas maybe their grandparents and parents were one way getting out of China. They were economic immigrants, wanting to go back, wanting to do business with China, wanting to engage with them. And that's been very interesting as well. It's an ongoing phenomenon.
Fascinating. Thank you very much for your impressions. I'm sure we'll follow up. But for now, thank you very much, both of you, for being online with us.
Thank you, Benjamin.
Thank you for reaching out.
That's Why China, the China podcast from Thuringia in Germany, sponsored by the German Federal Ministry of Research, Technology and Space.